Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the WUNC Tornado Shelter in downtown Raleigh, it is Thursday, June 22nd, 2017. Thanks for clicking play and tuning in to the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Today on the episode, we're chatting budgets, jihadists, and journalism. News and Observer politics and government reporter turned NC Insider editor Colin Campbell is your guest. Hey, Colin, how are you?
Hey, Jeff, how's it going?
It's going well. Are you budgeted out yet?
Almost. We're almost to the finish line. But, of course, the problem with the budget is even if the budget passes into law in the next couple days, which we'll see how long it takes the governor to veto it, we're still going to be finding things, and advocacy groups and lobbyists and others are going to be finding things in the budget that are newsworthy for weeks to come. And we won't know what they are because they're usually buried on page 236 somewhere.
We'll get to some of those surprises, some of the pork in a moment. As you started to look through this thing on Monday night or Tuesday morning.
Yeah, late Monday night.
What were some of your initial surprises? I mean, we've talked a lot about the big numbers, but was there anything, it could be a big number or a medium number or a medium policy issue. What surprised you initially when you looked at this budget?
I think the biggest surprise I found initially was that the tax cut provision was put off for a year. I kind of figured that, you know, obviously this happens every year. The Senate proposes a fairly big tax cut. The House proposes a tax cut that's somewhat smaller, and they end up somewhere in the middle. And in this case, Right. Yeah, it was a compromise, but it was sort of a compromise in the way that the Senate got what it wanted as far as a big tax cut, but it puts off a year, which I noticed sort of goes against what some of the conservative groups like Americans for Prosperity were saying they wanted, which was, hey, we had a big surplus this year. You owe it to the taxpayers to give them some of that money back.
Right.
And that didn't end up happening in a way to, I guess, allow for some of the more of the spending because they figure they're going to have more revenue next year just out of sheer revenue growth. So they can say they're going to do it next year, but not actually have anything change until 2019.
Right, right. So the tax numbers, I think the general numbers, the big numbers, $530 million tax cut over 2 years. I've seen from Americans for Prosperity, AFP, $3.6 billion over 5 years. And to your point, there was this, I guess we'll call it a wrangle, right, between the House and the Senate. The Senate didn't want – or the Senate wanted standard deduction increase and rate
and
decreases.
The rate, and then
and the House,
House
only
was just standard deduction,
right.
Yeah.
So is it – I mean, I look at it as it's a victory for the Senate because they got the rate reduction, rate cuts in there, and it's a lesser victory for the House because they were able to push that back beyond the next legislative election. Is that – do you look at it similarly?
Yeah, I think so. I do think it's a little bit difficult for them because I'm looking ahead to next year's budget, and right. Usually they try to give a little bit of tax relief in every budget, and it's going to be hard for them to do much if they're still waiting for the tax relief that they approved this year to actually become law. So perhaps they're doing their election year budget, and there's not really any changes to taxes that they can crow about.
Right. So our listeners, your readers, I think are probably at this point 4 or 5 days, depending on when they listen to this podcast, getting inundated or familiar with some of the big numbers, an average 3.3 raise for teachers, 1% bump for state retirees in terms of a pension. I wanted to ask you to kind of walk the listeners through the 2 year proposal for teachers. So what we're hearing is this is across 2 years, a 10% raise for teachers. So it's backloaded. First year, 3.3%. Next year, it's roughly 7%. But that might not necessarily transpire, right?
Yeah, that's something that, you know, if for some reason, when they get to April or May of 2018, for example, when they're ready to start this next part of the budget process, they're going to have to look at their revenue numbers again. And, of course, everyone will hope that the economy is doing well into next year and they actually have more money to work with and they can fund some more things in the second year sort of adjustment budget. But if we end up with a recession or just a down year, then you have less revenue to work with. And what they have to do is then look at what they funded this year and figure out somewhere to cut. So, you know, in one sense, yes, the teacher raises are in there for next year, but there's no guarantee that they stay that way and that the salary figures don't change somewhat before we get to the 2018-2019 school year.
Right. And it strikes me, not to sound too cynical about it, but it's a relatively high number to give teachers across the board on average. Is it 7?
Yeah, I think it's 7 because the big talking point is, well, it's a 10% raise over two years, and that's the argument is, well, that's what the governor wanted, but his raise plan looks substantially different from theirs.
Right. So not to sound too cynical, but it gives lawmakers wiggle room, right? Because if they can't meet that number, if there is an issue with revenue, collection, so on and so forth, even if they back that down to 4 or 5%, you still can say in an election year, hey, just months ago, we gave teachers this significant raise.
Yeah, and they can say, you know, it was the largest raise in however many years. I don't know how it compares historically, but certainly that's going to be a talking point you're going to hear going into 2018. And you're also going to be hearing that Democrats didn't support this budget and that supposedly they don't support these teacher raises, even though, of course, they were pushing for a different approach to teacher raises.
We are chatting on a Thursday afternoon. By the time some folks tune in or click play, they may very well have already heard news of a veto. And I guess if they act quickly enough, a veto and then an override. There's no way the governor doesn't veto this. I mean, he's signaled he will,
right? Yeah, the statement he put out shortly after the budget passed Thursday afternoon was that he will let us know his plans in the coming days. But this is a budget he said is the most irresponsible budget in history or in his memory. There's no way he can turn around and say, you know what, it's not that bad, I'll sign it. So I think it's just a matter of timing, and I don't know if there's sort of any strategic advantage to signing it later rather than signing it now. Certainly if he vetoed it now, the legislature could come back tomorrow or even do it later today and get their overrides out of the way. If he holds off a while, he does have 10 days to either sign or veto. He can sort of force them into more of a delay in their override process. That might mean we push up against July 1st, the beginning of the new fiscal year, and have to have a temporary budget. So he could throw a wrench in the works a little bit, even though he's going to get overridden.
And he can stay relevant. He can stay in the headlines on the radio as he does this. And for a governor who doesn't have a ton of power, that I think is an important play in all.
Yeah,
it's,
you know, the next few days will be a chance for him to get his message out further if he wants to do so. And I think he will. We've been hearing a lot from the governor's office and his staff about different provisions and different data that they want to get out there, including even the minute pork provisions that the Democrats have been criticizing. The governor's office has been instrumental in saying, hey, look at this and this and this. Are these part of, you know, the core functions of government that conservatives talk about?
We will chat pork in a moment. We're also going to chat rhetoric in a few moments and also right now. I was a little bit surprised, going back to your point a moment ago, about the governor at the press conference, I believe midday Tuesday this week, when he said this was the most irresponsible budget he's ever seen. Perhaps it needed the caveat of a conference report, a final budget, but he didn't say that. And my mind immediately went to the Senate budget that was passed, you know, within the last month, which had a half a billion dollars in additional tax cuts. It seemed the rhetoric just seems dialed up.
Yeah, that was because he said not only that, but it was worse than the original House or Senate budgets, which was surprising to me because there were a lot of cuts that the Senate made. Obviously, the tax cuts were bigger in the Senate plan. So a lot of things that Cooper would have objected to in the Senate plan wasn't in the final budget. So I'm not sure exactly what he meant when he said that somehow this is in some way worse than what was going through the Senate back before they agreed with the House and sort of moderated some things.
Right. And this is horse trading. You've written about it. I've talked about it. Funding in the Senate budget a month ago, a few weeks back, funding for the Wright School in Durham gone. STEM education funding gone. UNC Law School was going to get a 30% cut. They end up with about a 4% cut.
Yeah, Governor's School was gone in that budget. A number of different changes made. There was the food stamp provision in there to change eligibility requirements to knock tens of thousands of people off food stamps. That's not in the final budget. So,
so to say worse, it's a stretch.
From a Democrat's perspective, I think that's it's certainly a strong claim. But I mean, it's obviously just, you know, ratcheting up the rhetoric to get folks' attention. Because I mean, for those people who are out there and are not political junkies as we are, the budget process can seem kind of boring. So the more exciting the rhetoric is, the more people want to tune in.
Right. You've been here a little bit longer than I have covering the legislature. In my time, and I don't think in your time either, this level of pork has not made its way into the budget. This was kind of a new exercise, a new something for us. Yes.
Yeah, so I've actually, in the years I've been covering the legislature, it's been 2 or 3 years now, I always make a point of looking at what projects are in influential legislators' districts. And I usually do this like a month after the budget's passed because it doesn't get any attention during the actual debate process. And usually it's just, you know, $10,000 here, a million there for sort of the top budget writers, maybe some of the leadership, but not a whole lot.
Small, like,
yeah.
not hundreds.
Yeah, I mean, cumulatively, the years I was looking at it was maybe 20, 30 million total over across the budget. This year, the estimates I'm hearing is, you know, over $80 million, excuse me, yeah, with over 150, perhaps more, projects that folks would label pork as earmarks that are specifically, as we just planned sort of the process, you can put money into a specific program and then say some state agency can figure out based on an application process which communities, which areas, which organizations get this money. This is specifically naming one nonprofit in one town or a downtown revitalization in one town or perhaps not even a town. There were two unincorporated communities. One of them is the community of Cliffside out in western North Carolina. I looked it up on Google Maps. It doesn't have a downtown. It does have a Dollar General store. It's the only retail business in the entire community. And but they'll have downtown revitalization for, I think, $50,000 was sort of the average number for these revitalization grants.
All right. So we should note that pet projects, pork spending, earmarks, you can call them different things, happened under Republicans presently, have happened under Democrats in the past. And there's a lot of it in this budget, at least, again, compared to recent years. Democrats, I believe, in chatting with some lawmakers decades ago, Democrats did what used to happen is that there would be an allotment of money for a particular county, for Sampson County or Forsyth County or Rockingham County, and they would get $100,000 or $150,000. And then on the back end, lawmakers could, you know, kind of divvy it up and decide where it went. But at the same time, Mickey Mishaw has pointed out for a point of levity
that their names were attached to it. So you could see, OK, we're spending this on this project, but it representative whoever was the person doing it. Here you don't really know. And that's been sort of the challenge of covering these is you can kind of tell by counties, OK, this is an influential person. But with the case of Rockingham County, Phil Berger was pretty clear that the youth detention center that's in his county was something that he supports. But I asked him about another provision, which was kind of one that was a little bit more veiled. It had some kind of funky wording, but was clearly Rockingham County for a purchase of some game land. It's been described by the Democrats as a hunting lodge. I'm not positive whether there would actually be a lodge itself built under this provision. I asked Berger about it the other day, and he said, no, he didn't request that. He's aware of it, but was not his doing. So whose doing it was, we might never know.
And we both chatted with Senator Berger a couple of times this week, and I asked him about some of the pork spending. He made several points, and I don't even want to call them defenses necessarily. He said, I'll let you decide whether putting money toward Boys and Girls Clubs is pork spending or if that actually has a public benefit, a public impact. So that is just to, you know, offer the whole context.
And I will note as I looked through the list of these projects, there are actually a fair number of them that were in towns and communities hit by natural disasters recently. There's an allocation for, I think, the library in Fairbluff, which is one of those towns down by the South Carolina border that was completely flooded during Matthew. Obviously, struggling to recover. More recently, I think there's a provision in there for a fire station or EMS station in Autryville, the town in Sampson County that got hit by a tornado recently and I think impacted their emergency facilities there. So there's some stuff that you could argue, you know, you should put this in the budget because that'll get the money to these communities quickly and they're hurting and they need it.
Republicans will point to a time when Democrats earmarked money for a teapot museum in the western part of the state, which they say was a colossal waste of money. One other thing I guess I would just note, among the earmarks is $500,000 for a culinary arts program in Stanley County. I want to talk about Stanley County, but just noting that specific earmark. And I haven't heard specific criticisms to that, but I can imagine a criticism being that's money for a community college. There is an appropriations process, and this didn't go through that process. This was, you know, singularly identified.
Another community college somewhere else in the state could have also had a compelling case that they needed a similar program with similar money.
Right. Not vetted, not through committee, not heard. And now we get into the whole wonkiness of process in this place, which is a disaster as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I don't care who's running it. Stanley County, Justin Burr, got a whole bunch of earmark money, at least from what I identified. Some of it was for a state park, Morrow Mountain. Thank you. State park. For a livestock arena, for a culinary arts program. This isn't to insinuate there's anything wrong with that. I was a little bit surprised, and if you haven't noticed this, maybe you can't respond to it. It seemed as though Representative Burr got a whole lot of money in this. And he's an appropriations chair, so maybe not that surprising, but
But yeah, he's doing almost as well as, you know, the Speaker or perhaps the lead budget chair. The ones I've noticed in past years, Senate Budget Chairman Harry Brown gets a lot for the Jacksonville area and has for several years. But yeah, Burr is an interesting one because he for a while had a falling out with House Speaker Tim Moore, now seems to be in leadership's good graces. And certainly the money that we noticed going to Stanley is an indication that that perhaps he has some good clout now in where he sits.
Any theories, or and I'll put myself I'll put myself out there at this moment. I am surprised that he's been able to come back, so to speak, so quickly after crossing the Speaker. But I don't know what goes on behind closed doors. I do wonder about the relationship between Burr and former Majority Leader Mike Hager and Speaker Tim Moore. And Mike Hager, of course, is no longer here anymore. But Burr has gone from doghouse to one of the most influential.
And this was not a, you know, behind-the-scenes fight, if you recall. Right. This was – there were public letters going back and forth criticizing each other. And then there was an election where Burr faced some challengers. I mean, this was not a pretty discussion between these two men for a while. Right. But now that somehow they must have made peace, and I'm not sure what happened in that process to get to that point. But certainly Burr is back in good graces. And he's a young guy. He's probably early 30s. Yeah. So he's got potential to rise in leadership in this legislature if he sticks around for a while.
Colin Campbell is your guest on the WUNC Politics podcast this week. Your business card at this present moment says what?
So I'm technically the NC Insider Editor, which is the state government news service that the NNO owns. It goes out to lobbyists and other people who have a sort of inside view of government every morning and want sort of a comprehensive look at what's going on. But as of now, through the end of the session, I'm still the News and Observer political reporter as well. And of course, once I transition over, my stories will still run in the NNO. I'll get to pick up a column that'll run in some papers across the state. So some cool challenges ahead for me in working with the Insider.
You're a hybrid at the moment.
Yeah. You know, the joy of doing two jobs. It's the benefit of, hey, I just got a new job, but I still have to do the old one for a while.
But naturally, they're paying you twice the money, so that's great.
Yeah, that's totally what's happening.
A column. So you're going to start a column. Have you written a column before? Do you already have ideas for it? You don't have to share them, but where are you at with, oh, I get a column now. That's
interesting. You know, I haven't done one in a long time. I did one occasionally very early in my career when I was working in Johnston County at a community paper owned by the NNO, and I would occasionally write sort of a first-person thing. I've written about the process of buying a house or, you know, getting stopped by the police late at night and some quirky stuff. I haven't done a whole lot on politics. The challenge with that is going to be trying to shed light and shed a unique perspective on how this place in Raleigh functions, particularly for folks around the state who may not be following all the day-to-day minutia of it, while at the same time trying to avoid taking any sort of particularly opinionated stance that would lead anyone to believe that I lean one way or the other.
Yes. And learning your audience out. I mean, the audience of the Insider is smaller than the audience of the News and Observer. And I wouldn't necessarily say more passionate, but probably more in tune with what's going on in this
program. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they don't need the sort of general audience perspective or the reminders of, you know, what that tax cut looks like in the budget. But they want to get into the wonky stuff and the stuff that sort of affects particularly the business community of the state. So it's a chance to get a little bit more wonky, go to the committee meetings that a lot of my colleagues in the press corps get to skip because they're not the big news of the day. But hopefully, you know, break some new ground and report some stories where I get to be out on my own and not in the competitive environment of chasing everyone else around.
You are on Twitter at
@RaleighReporter. Yep.
Right. You're pretty active on Twitter. You got into it this week, or that's not fair. You didn't get into it this week. You were criticized this week by Senator Dan Bishop. I'm going to just set it up with that and let you tell us a little bit about
it. Yeah, so this was on Wednesday night after the budget votes. I was sharing a story that one of my colleagues had written about the cuts to the Attorney General's office, these big $10 million cut to Josh Stein's budget. Of course, he's a Democrat, and I've noted in my tweet that it was going to result in, according to Stein, about 123 job losses. Bishop then shares my tweet and says something to the effect of, petty jihad media at it again, carrying water, I guess ostensibly for Democrats, was the message there, which was interesting language. He's criticized my work before and called us corporate media, which is true. I am employed by a corporation. That's not an inaccurate statement.
Sure.
He's made some odd comments when I tweeted about almost getting hit by a Postal Service van in downtown Raleigh, suggesting that perhaps that wasn't a mistake. I assume he was joking, but it was always hard to tell with Twitter. But he's getting a lot of criticism now for this jihad media comment. And he not only directed it at me, but I think was directing it at some CNN reports. He's a very active Twitter voice, kind of very pro-Trump guy, very similar personality in terms of how he presents himself in the Twitter format. And it's been fascinating to watch him and sort of watch the reaction or lack of reaction from other Republicans.
Right. That's a very important point. Strong language. I would even venture to say it is incendiary language. This, of course, comes at a time politicians and media press members fighting is nothing new, but you know, the opposition party, fake news. I mean, there's more of an attack in this. I'm not really sure. I will attribute what I'm going to say to a Republican staff member who I asked about it this week. I said, what did you make of Senator Bishop's tweets? This is a Republican now. And he said he used the word ignorant. He said those are ignorant. I don't know who serves to benefit from that. It's certainly dialed up. And I don't know who it benefits. And the decorum went out the window with that is from my perspective.
Yeah.
Senator Berger's office weighed in on this, kind of?
Yeah, saying it was like a bad word choice was as far as – but that they sympathize with his concerns about media bias, that things are in state media are liberally slanted, and that perhaps that media hasn't done as good a job of calling out particularly Reverend William Barber's fairly incendiary remarks about the legislature, saying that they're, you know, racist or right-wing extremist, I think of some language he's used recently. So, I mean, it's across the board. I mean, both parties are using very strong language, both at the state and the national level now. It's being directed at politicians, and there's arguments being made that that perhaps contributed to the shooting of members of Congress. It's being directed at members of the media, which perhaps emboldened that one congressional candidate to body slam the reporter. So, I mean, I think everybody needs to calm down a notch and remember that media are people. Politicians are also people. They have families. They have feelings. And we can disagree on the issues, but maybe not just act like we're in middle school and call each other names.
Right. I would agree with that, and we'll move on from there. I'm going to do a few quick ones with you here. Favorite part of your job, getting to cover politics, what do you most look forward to?
I think finding something that nobody else has found, whether it's in a budget bill or just getting a good tip in this, you know, miniature house of cards that we work in here at the legislature. It's always fun to kind of get into the political intrigue aspect of it beyond just the day-to-day, you know, explainer stories and there was a vote, there was a bill sort of stories.
Right. What do you hate most about this job?
Probably the hours. I find it very hard to tune out because there's just constantly news breaking in the political world. And my wife would tell you I'm a terrible Twitter addict. That she tries to convince me to put down my phone at night with limited success so that I can actually relax and read a book and, you know, have a life outside of work. And it's a difficult balance to have, particularly the way politics has been in the state the last couple of years. I'm certainly looking forward to the end of the legislative session that we might, assuming there's nothing crazy that pops up, get a little bit of a break, knock on wood,
yes.
You know, to not be dealing with stuff. Because we've, in the press corps, we've had the session, we've had elections, we've had special sessions, we've had HB2. I mean, the last almost 2 years now have just been wall-to-wall major news here in North Carolina.
Right. With a national spotlight, there really hasn't been much of a dip or a slowdown period. Gary Robertson, AP reporter, has talked about that on the podcast. There used to be, you know, a built-in period late in the year where it just quieted down and things folded up, and it hasn't done that yet. Representative David Lewis on the floor this week invoked the name of Nickelback during budget debates. What is your guiltiest music listening pleasure?
Oh, I think that would have to be the song "Kiss Me" by Sixpence None the Richer. That very like incredibly sappy like love song from 10 years ago. That was been a favorite of mine for a long time. But
from high school, college,
Range. Yeah, I've got lots of old music on my iPod from back in the day, and then a few like angry rock things. Like I don't like Nickelback or Creed, but there are some sort of angry rock bands that were popular in the early 2000s during my brief stint as an alternative rock DJ that I got into at the time and still kind of like, even though I've perhaps matured in my musical taste since.
If you were not a reporter, what would you do to make a living?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I've love to go back into sort of doing music or radio sort of stuff. City planning has always seemed sort of interesting to me.
Oh, yeah.
If I ever wanted to go back to school, but certainly journalism is the top of the list, and I'm hopefully we'll get to stay in it for a while.
I hope so. We will be reading your columns. Beginning when? When do the columns?
Probably the end of session, maybe towards the end of July. We'll start having those and get to see what it looks like when I've got a little more of an informal voice in the paper rather than sticking to the formal news structure.
And more time where you're not covering the budget.
Yeah, exactly. So that'll be a benefit.
Colin Campbell of the Raleigh News and Observer and the NC Insider, leaving the former to join the latter. You can read his work online, and of course you can follow him on Twitter at Raleigh Reporter. Colin, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for tuning into the WUNC Politics Podcast. You, of course, can share this program on social media. Tell your friends, colleagues, neighbors, enemies, whoever about it, and subscribe wherever it is that you tune into podcasts. And throughout the week, stay informed with all the political news at our website, WUNC.org. For Colin Campbell, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Talk to you soon.